everybody. It is 12-12, 12-12-18, and I am super, super excited because I get to talk to Kristen Johnston today, who's standing by, and I've got so many interesting little stories that before I get into it, I don't want to get lost, and I just want to remind people that you could support the show by becoming a monthly subscriber at patreon.com/startmeup. You can do $1 a month. $5 a month gets you into our End Another Thing segment, or you could just do $10 a month because you love me and you love Steph, who couldn't be here, by the way, and was devastated, and she says hello to Kristen. And so for all of you out there, you must know who she is. She was like the big, huge star on Third Rock from the Sun. She's currently on CBS's Mom, and she wrote an amazing book that I just finished called Guts. And we're going to get into all of that. So without further ado, hello, Kristen.
Hi, Kimberly. How are you?
I'm so good. And you just don't even know. I'm like tickled because I have to tell you these two quick stories. First of all, the way we met on Twitter was I saw something that you tweeted and I was like, oh my God, it's Kristen Johnston. And I tweeted to you and I said that I had auditioned to be your stand-in when the show was...
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, the show was called Life as We Know It. And the funny thing about that was that the reason I even got, you know, the audition for that was I had signed up for something because I wanted my SAG card. You know, if you're not a union actor, you can't work union gigs. So I signed up for this thing where they would send you out on auditions for union projects. And if you got three, whether you got the part or not, you would get your SAG card. So...
you mean if you just went on the audition?
Yeah, if you auditioned for three union parts, you got that. I don't know if the rules still apply, but that's how it was back then. So I went.
Pretty awesome. Okay.
Yeah, I went. I think I remember seeing you, but I don't really remember. But I didn't want the job because I figured I'm just going to be stuck as a stand-in for someone, and I'm always going to be looked at as a stand-in, and you know, it's going to ruin my huge career.
Well, that's true. I mean, that is true. It's very hard to break out of something like that. It's really hard.
Yeah, I've gone back and forth.
Put you in a box, and you're kept there.
Yeah, and I've gone back and forth in my mind wondering, like, what if I had done it? What if they would have thrown me a bone? But, you know, I did what I threw it on purpose. They asked me about my... eligibility for time and all of that, and I lied and said I couldn't do it, and then I was, you know, free to go, and then that
was obviously you're very tall.
Yes,
if you were going in as my stand-in.
You know, I honestly think I could have gotten it. I'm 6 feet. Yes, I'm 6 feet tall. I'm actually 5'11¾". But
okay,
what's the difference? But you know,
it's always funny because whenever I go on a job, I always know who my stand-in is. Giant blonde.
Well, I think I would have got it, you know, because I think we were so close. I mean, I have broader shoulders than you do, but still, I mean, we're very similar. But then
a lot of people may not know what a stand-in does.
So,
I mean, I don't know.
Tell us.
I mean, basically, a stand-in is when they do camera angles and they do the boring lighting stuff. The actors get to leave and go eat at craft services, and the stand-ins have to stand there, and so they can light you properly and they can tell you where to stand. So it's kind of like the worst job ever, but also, you know, a great way to get to know what a set, you know, how to deal with on a set. You know, you meet directors and lighting designers, so it's fun. But I mean, I think after a while you get pretty bored. I would imagine.
Yeah, I would definitely imagine. And just the other little funny story before we totally go into everything you is years later, I was in this acting studio where we would invite casting directors and then, you know, it was a group of us, and then they would find scenes, they would give us scenes, and then we would go off, a partner would go off, and we would, you know, like I had this one guy who was my partner, and so we would go off and do a rehearsal of whatever scenes they gave us and then perform them in front of the casting director.
Yeah.
And then later on, if they thought you were right for a role, they would call you. So I had always been terrified of comedy, and I avoided it like the plague. It just scared the shit out of me. So Gail Pillsbury, who was the casting director for Third Rock, came in. And I was like, that's it. I gotta throw down, man. I gotta be good. So I was paired with this guy who was not good. And we got the little scene, and he read it once with me, and he screwed this one very important part up, and then didn't want to read it with me anymore. He didn't want to rehearse. He just wanted to go off in a corner and study the lines. And I was so irritated So anyway, we, you know, I rehearse myself, and then together we go up in front of Gale, and once again, he screws up in that crucial time, but because he had screwed up once, I was kind of anticipating it, so I saved it, and then I heard Gale laugh out loud, and I was so, like, thrilled. I just thought, oh my God, if I can make her laugh out loud, I can be funny. So anyway...
Well, then you discovered the addiction that is yes. comedy, right?
Yes, but I have to say, I'm nowhere near where you are, but I felt... No, and I mean it. I felt really good. But then, so Gale called me in straight to producer, which means I didn't have to go on any regular auditions. I just,
right.
It means you're good enough for the part, but now are you right for the part?
Yeah.
So I got two different auditions, and I knew I wasn't going to get them because one, and you probably don't remember the scene, but it was you, and I'm sure it was the other castmates of yours, and you're sitting at like a diner, and so the role was like the waitress looking at you and saying something like, "There's more fish in the sea, honey," because you were complaining about your boyfriend.
Oh yeah, okay, yeah.
And so I thought, well, they're just going to hire an older woman, which they did. And then the other scene that I was up for was to play French Stewart's girlfriend, and I thought, oh my God, they're going to hire some cute little waif. And they did.
And you know what? I think that was the part he ended up marrying her.
Really?
That was the woman he ended up marrying for a long time. Yeah.
Wow.
I think that one might have been her. I'm not sure. But I think he had a couple girlfriends on the show. But, well, that's weird. So we've been like two ships passing in the night that finally crashed on Twitter.
I know. Totally. Oh, my God. That's just so funny. Yeah, I've always identified with you, obviously, because you're tall, you're blonde, you're outspoken, you're sarcastic, you're very funny. And, you know, I'll get into this later. But I'm curious to know, because I read your book, Guts, which we will definitely get into. But I just want to stick with this Third Rock for a minute. You had mentioned in your book that the instant fame was difficult for you to deal with. And I'd like to just know a little more. I'd like you to go a little in depth about that and talk about that.
Well, you know, now, of course, I'm totally fine about it. But, you know, it took me a long time to figure out why I had such an adverse reaction to it. Because honestly, you know, growing up and wanting to be an actress, I would never have thought I would have had difficulty adjusting to it. You know, I just was like, this is what I'm meant to do. I can't wait. And then it happened, and it was, you know, overnight, and it was very, it changes your life a lot. How you move through the world is suddenly very arrested, and you have to just comport yourself differently. But it took me a long time to kind of realize why it felt so uncomfortable. And I think what it was, you know, as a young person, I was so tall, so young, and I was made fun of a lot as, you know, in grade school and in high school, and people talking about me and pointing at me. So fame to me actually felt really malevolent for a long time. It felt like people were gossiping and scaring and pointing, and that it was a negative energy. And it took me a long time to realize that people were just coming from a really positive place, and that it was actually a really positive thing. So for a long time, it just felt instinctively like I need to fight or flight. And I think that was why I reacted to it. Look, it took a couple years of adjustment, and then I got over it. But yeah, that initially it felt really like a negative thing.
Wow. I wondered about that, you know, as I pursued acting. I never gained fame or anything like that. I had a few small parts here and there. I had a nice little recurring role on a soap opera, but it, you know, I wasn't recognized out on the street or anything like that. So I can imagine it must be weird. I mean, I know that, you know, Bob and I,
it's a weird state to be in, but you know, it's obviously there's a lot worse in life that could happen to you, and you know, you get over it. But initially it feels, you know, as someone who is a natural observer, I love people watching, I love being an observer and looking at how different people deal with, I mean, you know, you study humanity as an actress, you know, and all of a sudden I became very self-conscious in my life. Like all of a sudden the focus went back on me, and it really was uncomfortable for a long time. It made me really self-conscious.
Yeah, well, yeah, I mean, I understand that in that Bob will often go to these, I don't know if you know Stephanie Miller, she's on the radio, she's a liberal.
Yeah,
okay, so anyway,
sure.
he and John Fugelstang, or she and John Fugelstang, have a show that they do every year, Sexy Liberal Comedy Tour. And Bob is on Stephanie's show every Wednesday. So we'll go, and Bob's usually a part of it. So afterward, we get to meet people who are fans of the show. And it's funny, because when you're standing there and people recognize you and they're excited to meet you, it's almost awkward, because you're not used to people being so happy to see you. it's one thing to just meet someone.
That's fine. Cause, an hour of your life. I think where it gets weird, or the adjustment is needed, is when it's every minute of every day, of every second. You're running into the store and all of a sudden someone wants to talk to you for an hour. It's just a part of your life. And look, again, I really don't mean to sound like a jerk. It is a lovely thing, but just, it does take a couple of years to adjust.
Sound like a jerk. I mean, I think anybody would need the adjustment time. It's a jarring thing, to be instantly famous.
That's a great way to put it. Yeah, it's jarring. But then you get over it, and then, you move on.
So
you have to.
Now, okay, so Third Rock ended in what year?
Oh, my God, don't ask me that. I have no idea. Maybe 2000, 2001, maybe? I don't know.
It might have gone on longer. Well, I don't know. Maybe it's 2004 or I don't remember. But so then...
I think it was 2001, because I think I how everything is in relation to September 11th.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
Yes.
So Third Rock had just ended when September 11th happened.
Okay.
So 2001.
So after Third Rock, what were you doing as an actress? You were doing plays?
Well, I moved right back to New York and did theater for years. I mean, I did theater for a very long time and purposely didn't do television, turned down a lot of stuff. And I just really wanted to get back to my, my original goal, which was always just to be in New York and do theater. So I had a great time, but of course I was out of the public eye. The majority of people thought I disappeared, but in reality, I was busy doing theater.
Hmm. And so now this kind of goes into your book, but it's like pre-book. So during that time, you were doing, what was it, Vicodin and wine?
Right. Well, I got into, the use of painkillers and the abuse of painkillers started on Third Rock, but I was highly functioning. Mm-hmm. It wasn't every day, but it certainly, my relationship with drugs and alcohol started on Third Rock, but it became much, a real problem. Once I moved back to New York, not the pills as much initially. It was really just booze. Mm-hmm. It's hard. It's the lifestyle of doing plays, and you go out for drinks afterwards, mm-hmm. and it just becomes part of the life there. And then within a couple of years, I started taking the painkillers again, and right away, it became a problem.
Wow.
Right away. I mean, I just became a full-blown addict for a long time, for 5 or 6 years.
And then during that time, you were doing plays?
Stopped. The time what?
During that time, you were doing theater?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I was very careful not to use... I wasn't high on stage.
Mm-hmm.
I never was high on stage. But the rest of the time, pretty much, yeah.
Wow.
And then there was a long time where I stopped doing theater and just did drugs.
Wow.
I mean, it takes over your life.
Yeah.
And that became very dangerous.
Yes,
that was
absolutely.
When, when you have free time and a lot of extra income,
yeah.
and you're a drug addict, it's really a bad combination.
Oh. So then, now, I just, like I said, finished reading your book, which was so terrific. And
please let your audience know I have been sober for a very long time.
Oh,
so,
absolutely,
it's not
absolutely.
A problem I'm struggling with, but yeah.
Right, it was something that you've overcome, and that's what you talk about in Guts. It's you shared your story of what happened to you, and then that long road, or it wasn't that long, it doesn't sound like, but it was a long road to get you to where you were like, all right, I'm ready to stop now. And then you stopped.
Yeah, and my body basically said game over. My guts blew up from abuse of painkillers. And so I really had no choice. Obviously, I had a choice. I could die or I could die or stop. And I chose to stop.
Right.
And it was, you know, really difficult, but, you know, something I'm very proud of and so happy I did.
Oh, I can totally imagine. And I mean, reading your account, you know, you were in London doing a play and you had explained, and I was curious about, you had explained you were on the loo and you heard, like you heard a rip.
Yeah.
So like you literally heard your stomach open up.
Stabbing my stomach. I mean, with a knife. It was so painful. And I definitely go into the details in the book of, you know, sort of this night from hell that I experienced. And, this kind of nightmare of really dying, alone in a foreign city, and dying, you know, from my abuse of drugs. And it, you know, all just sort of caught up with me this at 4 a.m. on a London evening. So, and that's why I called it guts. It's sort of a double meaning, obviously.
Right.
I mean, it takes a lot of guts to look yourself in the mirror and be honest with yourself and fight to get sober. And it also is about literally about my guts. My guts just blew up. I mean,
yeah.
It was pretty amazing that I lived through.
I liked reading, you start the book and you kind of talk about your life growing up, and you do mention the fact that you were tall and that you felt different, which of course I can relate to. I mean, you had mentioned that someone called you the Jolly Green Giant. It's like, hello, I heard that so many times.
Yeah, yeah. Right.
Especially when you're a tall girl.
Yeah, kids are so original, you know.
This one guy used to call me Big Mama. And so
I can't believe that. That's awful. Oh, I'm so glad they didn't get to that with me.
Well, I always hated it because I don't like when people would say you're so big. It's like, Jesus Christ.
Yeah, no, I hate the word big.
Yeah, me too. It's like tall, I can deal with. Big, it's like, gee, thanks.
Yeah.
And then I used to work in restaurants and all the in LA restaurants, and the Mexican guys that would work there would go grandota, which I guess means big. And
oh,
it was like, I was always called grandota.
Oh my God. There's something about being tall and blonde too. It's like catnip for short guys to sort of harass. It's amazing.
And that's the funny thing. It's always
really
the short
guys. I don't remember too many tall guys giving me crap.
No.
It's mostly like short guys. So it's like, you know.
They either give you crap or they want to marry you on sight. And then just the other thing I just wanted to throw in there, and I want to get to body image in a minute, but you know, you had said, like, as I mentioned, there are so many things that I feel that we have in common. Not everything. Our upbringings were very different, but still the fact that we were tall, sarcastic, and all of that. But you had mentioned your acne prone skin, and I have acne prone skin. You know, it was something that I dealt with just before I decided to pursue an acting career. So aside from my, my obsession with my body image, and you know, part of my obsession came because I was tall, and that I have large feet, large hands, large bones.
I
felt different. It's like I'll admit that, you know, like I would look at someone like you and I would feel envy because I envied your frame. You had slender legs and slender arms. I mean, I was very slender at one point.
No, I know exactly what you're saying. I mean, but then there's a thing about, you know, someone with your frame where you can pull, you can pull off curves better than someone like me. You know what I mean? So the grass is always greener.
Right. It's
totally
true.
I do have very small hands and small feet, which is why I'm such a klutz. Like my balance is off. So it's, you know, whatever. The thing that's weird about me though is honestly, I'm the only actress I know who doesn't have anorexia or body dysmorphia. I actually have always been pretty okay with my weight. You know, I prefer it when I'm thinner because who doesn't?
Yeah.
But like, I've never had that big self-hatred about my body. I've certainly hated myself, you know, and I've hated who I am at certain points in my life, but my physicality has, I don't know, other than my height, I've never really cared too much about it, which is weird.
God, I wish I still battle with it. And it's like, I wish that I could have that.
Well, like nowadays, like now I've gained a ton of weight because of, I got lupus 3 years ago, got diagnosed with lupus, and the medication that I'm on, it's like steroids and whatever.
Yeah.
I gained like 80 pounds. And, you know, and then of course, and then I'm got on the show Mom. So that's a struggle. It's hard to see yourself like suddenly gain a ton of weight and then you're on television. But I also am like, look, you know, I'm walking. Yeah. I'm alive. Who gives a shit, you know?
Yeah.
So I'm a little fatter than I'd like to be. I don't care because I feel good, you know, right. And I'm not sick right now. So if the price I have to pay to, like, be able to walk through the world as a healthy person is to take medication that makes me big, then I'll just be big, you know? Yeah. So I'm actually okay with that. It bugs me that it's everyone else's focus. Is so on it.
Right.
Like on Twitter, you know, a lot of people give me shit because I dislike our president a lot, as you know.
I wonder why.
I think that's something we share. And I get a lot of grief from, you know, pro-Trump people. And a lot of them have used that, like my weight, yeah, as some sort of, you know, offensive tool. You know, and it just, you know, it's ridiculous to me. It's just so stupid. And it's something that actually doesn't hurt my feelings. Yeah. If they want to hurt my feelings, they should make fun of my talents or something.
Right.
But to sort of make fun of my physicality, it's like, I don't know. And also, anybody that wants to judge someone else's physicality, I think they should include a picture of themselves before they do so.
Yeah, naked.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. And that's always definitely what I've strived for. In fact, when I have, you know, self-pity moments where, you know, I'm not happy with my legs or something, every single time that happens, I go out and I see somebody who doesn't have legs or is in a wheelchair. And I think, what is your freaking problem?
Well, you know? See, for me, my lupus, initially before I was diagnosed, I basically, what happened to me is I stopped being able to walk. So I was actually in a wheelchair because the lupus I have, it's lupus myelitis, and it basically means my immune system attacks my spinal cord. So I basically was unable to walk for about 6 months. I mean, in a wheelchair, literally unable to hold my head up. So the fact that I got diagnosed, had, you know, a major treatment, and now it's in remission, and I just take pills every day to keep it in check, and I'm totally fine otherwise. I'm like, you know, I'll take it. Whatever you want to give me, I will take over the choice of being unable to walk.
Oh my God,
so I just care how I feel now with how I felt then, and it's like, look, if you want me to carry around a little extra weight so that I feel good, then that's what's going to happen.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, and, you know, getting to Mom, I mean, I'm just going to say it. You're the best part of that show. And I mean, I didn't, and I'm not saying that to kiss your ass.
Well, I beg to differ, but thank you.
I'm seriously not saying that to kiss your ass. I know that, you know, you're here and all of that, so it sounds good, but it's the truth. And I didn't watch the show until I was aware that you were on it. And now it's kind of like my little Friday ritual where I just kind of lay in bed and have my computer on my lap and watch. And the last show, you made me laugh out loud so hard when you ran out the door to your date.
Wait, which one? Was it the date episode?
Yes, the date episode when you were standing there. You came out in your dress and you're all fancy and shiny and pretty. And then he was outside and you couldn't get out of the door fast enough. That exit was so funny. Oh my God. I literally laughed out loud, and you're the person that makes me laugh out loud.
I had so much fun doing it. You know what I love about the show? I mean, first of all, it's about how to, for me, watching the show for a couple of years before I was on it, you know, it was the first, it really is an introduction to how to have fun and still laugh even in sobriety.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's hilarious. It makes fun of all of it. And, you know, keeping your sense of humor as a sober person is pretty important. And so I love that. But my favorite element of the show, I mean, obviously the writing, the acting, but the fact that it's about these women.
Mm-hmm.
I just love it. They're cool women. They're not like, the, you know, bunch of women on The View or whatever, or The Talk. Like, they're funny, cool women that you would want to hang out with.
Yeah,
I just love that. I think it's huge, and I think it's so important. And obviously, as a fellow feminist, I mean, I think that it would be something you would really respond to as well. Like, you know, about the flaws and foibles of real women.
Yeah,
you know, and they're real. And the thing that's amazing about it is, the women on the show, you know, and backstage, they are all just the greatest people. I mean, they're just, it's an amazing group. There's none of that women fighting each other weirdness. It's all just people who are just over it and ready to just have fun, and we all realize how lucky we are. So it's a pretty great job. I love it.
Well, I guess good actors could hide bad relationships, but it seems to kind of come off that you guys all have a great chemistry and that
we
you
really
have
do.
A fun time. And it must be so amazing working with Allison Janney. I know, I've always been a fan
of hers. Yeah, it's pretty incredible. I mean, I've known her for a long time socially, you know, from New York theater scene. I've always really loved her, obviously love her acting so much. And working with her as an actress, you know, there's that weird chemistry thing. I, you know, it's just we love working together.
Yeah.
Well, at least I should only speak for myself. I mean, I love acting with her. I can't wait to get to work every day and play with her. So it's pretty great.
And so when you
I've
were
been very lucky in that regard.
When you were hired, were you just hired for like a one day thing or a one show thing?
And yeah. Last year they called me and they said, you know, we want to introduce somebody from Bonnie's past, that she grew up with in foster care and she's in prison. And I was like, done.
And
I'll
wait, why were you in prison?
Huh?
Why were you in prison?
Yeah. I was in prison disconnected my phone for a second. I was in prison for, I think I held up an Outback Steakhouse. Yeah. I tried to rob an Outback Steakhouse and it was top seat for free night or something. So of course like 36 policemen arrested me or something. So that's the great thing about this character though, is she's, you know, been in prison for a long time and she just gets out. And so she's obviously very savvy and kind of been there, done that, but she's also really innocent. Mm-hmm. Like the first episode this year, she just freaks out like, what the hell is coconut milk water? You know, she doesn't understand what these things are. So it's fun to play that, you know. She doesn't understand that, like, you know, you can hands-free is a thing you can do on the phone. Like, she doesn't understand social media. She just missed like so much of like what's happened in the world in the last 10 years. So seeing her discover all that stuff is pretty fun.
Yeah, it must be really fun playing her, especially because the character, like you said, there's a bit of savvy and a bit of innocence where you have to find that fine line.
Yeah.
And walk.
Yeah,
that.
Yeah. She's dumb and smart at the same time. Well, it's more than me, even me playing it. You know, the writers, I think, have a lot of fun writing her. I mean, I think you can tell that. They've also said that to me. So, you know, I think it's been fun for them too. And, you know, we get all the credit, all the actors do. But the real gift is the writing.
Yeah.
You know, that's really the trick to any successful film or show or play. It's all in the writing.
Yeah.
So I owe it all to them if you like it.
So just indulge me for a minute about a typical day on the show. What kind of hours do you work? Do you work?
It's really ridiculous how easy. I mean, if you're on an hour, like a film drama, like an NCIS or whatever, that job is so hard. It's, you know, 16 hours a day, you know, it's every day. It's really hard. Sitcoms are ridiculously easy. Every day is different. Like Monday, we get to work and we do the table read of the script, and then we sort of put the show up on its feet in a really loose fashion. And then Tuesday, we rehearse, and then we do a run through at the end of the day. Same thing with Wednesday. And then Friday, we pre-shoot half the show. And then Friday, we rehearse and then shoot the rest of the show in front of an audience. But the hours, like Friday's a really long day. But Monday, you know, we show up at 10 and leave at noon.
Wow.
Ridiculous. Yeah. It's a great job. It really is.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, my limited experience in acting, I was obviously on Days of Our Lives. And I mean, I was only...
That is the hardest job. So I did a couple soaps. Those are long, hard hours.
Yeah, well, they are definitely if you're a main player, which I was not. Although there were days on there where I would get called in at like, and I'd have to be there at 8 o'clock in the morning, and then I was there until 9 or 10 o'clock at night if they had one of those galas or something, and everyone was on. But then there were other times where I would literally be called in, you know, at like 1, and I'd be out by 3. So it was just.
I mean, it all depends. Yeah. I mean, for Friday when we shoot the show, you know, we get there at like 11 or noon, and we're there until 10 or 11 at night. So, you know, it varies, but there, it's the best job you can get as an actress. Wow. I think sitcoms is the best job. It really is.
That's really, that's interesting to me, because I always wondered about that. You know, I certainly do love my sleep. And I thought, what if I get a sitcom? Am I going to be able to have, you know, enough sleep? But obviously, yes, you do. But I can imagine the 1 hour
shows. Yeah, and
then,
of course, if you do a film or something, you get no sleep. I mean, you get like an hour. So, you know, it all evens out in the end, I guess.
I wanted to ask you, too. You said cigarettes were the hardest thing you ever quit. So, obviously, you've overcome an addiction to alcohol and pills, which I'm sure was incredibly difficult. So why would you say cigarettes was harder?
Cigarettes was harder. Well, I think I had more of a long relationship with cigarettes.
Yeah.
And I don't know why they're harder. I mean, I think it's because there's not only your emotional addiction, there's also and your physical addiction, but there's also the ritualistic addiction.
Yes.
You know, something to do with your hands.
Yes.
You know, sucking in, it's just something about cigarettes was so hard for me.
Yeah.
I think I tried to quit like 12 times.
Yeah,
until I finally did it forever, probably 2.5 years ago now.
Well, congratulations.
But it took a long time. Thank you.
What was the thing
but
that
also,
made you...
I mean, it's really, nothing makes you look more disgusting than cigarettes.
I was kind of like a closet cigarette smoker. I mean, I smoked just as much as you, a pack a day or whatever it was. But I would hide it from people. I wouldn't lie about it. I just wouldn't, you know, if I knew that my friend was not a smoker, I didn't tell them that I was. And, you know, I mean, one time, my girlfriend, I used to work in department stores as a fragrance model. So I would work for the fragrance company, but not for the store. So anyway, I would, you know, smoke on my way home. And I'd always have my arm hanging out the window because I didn't want the smoke on me. And so anyway, like years I'd been there.
Well, you know what's weird is,
No, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say that, you know, you think you're covering it up as a smoker. You're like, you know, take the breath mint, put the perfume on, keep the windows open. And then you quit smoking and you can smell immediately when someone's had a cigarette like 6 hours before, you know. I mean, it stinks.
It smells awful. And I did have it down pretty good to hide it because I would, you know, I would hold my girlfriend used to make fun of me and say, here's my impression of Kimberly smoking. And then she'd sit down and hold her arm as far out as she possibly could, because I know like the smoke would come up on your hair. And so this way I would always keep it away from me and I would have my breath mints and all of that. But one day I went out with a girlfriend to smoke and I came back and my other girlfriend said, oh my God, you smell like cigarettes. And she had known me for years and it was the first time she'd ever smelled cigarettes on me. So I was pretty good at hiding it. But, you know, I wanted to ask you, what was like, was there something different about this last time that you, the final time you decided to quit smoking, or was this just, it just worked this time?
Each time I was really serious about it. I don't know what was different this time. I just had it. I just wanted to finish it.
Right.
And, I knew, and the trick is, you know, the first 3 days are hell.
Yeah.
And then it's really just not getting in the habit anymore. And something that really helps people is like if you keep, you know, you make rules for yourself that you have to follow. Like you cannot smoke in your car and you cannot smoke in your house. And if you keeping the window of when it's okay to smoke smaller and smaller, that helps. But also what helps is the fact that it's not allowed anywhere. And so you know, it's freezing winter in New York and snow and hail, and you're sitting out there, you know, you can't even bring your hand up to your mouth with cigarettes. It's trembling. You're freezing. And you're like, look at yourself, like, what the hell am I doing? You know? What a loser. So, and the other thing, the trick to quitting smoking is literally never, ever, ever have another cigarette. Mm-hmm. And that's the thing that I kept screwing up. I'd be like, oh, I'll just have one. You know, I'll just be one of those people. And the thing is, I'm an addict. I can't ever have one of anything.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you know, for me, it was really weird because I smoked for a long time. I was heavily addicted and everything you said, but it was actually very easy for me to quit smoking because I used those e-cigarettes and basically I decided, which are terrible and they give you, they kill your lungs, but I didn't want to replace smoking with those. I wanted to use them as a little crutch in a small window of time, which is exactly what I did. So I bought the lowest form of nicotine, and then I would take one or two hits and it would make me cough. So I didn't tolerate them very well. So what I would do is like in a 2-week period, I would because you know when you're a smoker, you think, you know, when you quit smoking, it's that little voice inside of your head that argues, I want a cigarette, I want a cigarette. So I would just push that aside and say, you know what, I can have a hit of my little e-cigarette and I'll wait for an hour. Mm-hmm. And I would just push it and push it and push it. So I
the thing is that if you remember, and this is actually really helpful to people who are listening, who are thinking about quitting something, is the craving, whether it's for drugs, alcohol, cigarettes, it lasts, if you can hold it, if you can hold back for a minute, literally 1 minute, you'll move past the craving.
Right, and that's what I
would do. Craving, when it hits, feels like it's going to be forever, and it's not. It's like a minute.
Yeah, exactly. And that's why, that's what I would do. I would tell myself, all right, I'm going to get over this little hump of wanting a hit, and I'll just put it off, and I'll have it later. And then I would just put it off and put it off and put it off. And so I would have, maybe to begin with, I would have about 4 or 5 hits a day. And then what I would do, since I couldn't even really inhale it because it made me cough, I would just like take a puff and then watch all the vapor blow out of my mouth, because that was also part of it, just like watching the smoke. And then in 2 weeks, I was done. And I've never looked back. I've never wanted a cigarette. And the first time that I was ever around anyone who smoked after I quit was over a year, and I was repulsed. And I'm not one of those judgy people that's going to judge other people for smoking, but I'm
so sickened
by it now. It's like, oh my God, the smell just makes me so sick. And I can't even imagine what it would be to inhale.
Yeah, no, I don't ever want to go back to that. But, you know, the thing is, you know, people, it's a really difficult thing to quit for a lot of people, much more challenging than, you know, thank God, what you face. People, there are a lot of people that it's, you know, every day, it's part of their life. And same with drugs or alcohol. And the whole thing is that people need to remember is, first and foremost, it's totally individual. Mm-hmm. What works for someone else may not and probably will not work for you.
Yeah.
Whether it's 12-step or support groups or whatever it helps you. And so you have to find what works for you. Some people it's exercise. Some people it's what you did, e-cigarettes, whatever it is. There are different things that work for different people. So I think what's difficult is when people enforce on everyone else, like, here's how I did it.
You have to do it
the only way it works.
Yeah.
And that's bullshit. I mean, it's so individual. And whatever helps you not to use.
Yeah. And it, well, and that, I had tried quitting smoking so many times and did exactly what you did. In fact, where I used to live, there was this little store that would sell single cigarettes for 25 cents. And, you know, I would go and buy four of
those.
Yeah. And it's like, I just could, for a long time, I would maybe smoke 4 a day, but it always goes back to, you know, a pack or more. So it was very difficult. And it took me a long time.
Yeah.
But finally, thankfully, I was able to kick the habit as well. And that, and there's
good for us.
Yes.
And you know, anybody out there who's listening to this, who's thinking about it, you know, you can do it. I mean, it's not easy, but it's totally doable.
I have my list of questions for you here, and I'm.
Oh, you haven't even started on those.
No, we're going down. And
okay. Good.
And my next one is about Sex and the City, but the one that follows Sex and the City, all I have is the word eat, and I have no idea what that even means. I don't even know what I was thinking. Anyway, I wanted to talk about Sex and the City. First of all, it's like eat. Okay. Anyway, so Bob and I love watching. I first of all, let me just start with when Sex and the City first came out, as so many shows do, I just thought, oh, that doesn't sound interesting to me. And I just, you know, I judged it. I thought it was going to be this like, you know, kind of real sex kind of, I don't know. I didn't even know what to, I just thought it was going to be smarmy. And so yeah. It was, I thought the same thing. I thought The Sopranos was about, literally about, you know, opera singers. So what do I fucking know? But anyway, oh my God. Then it became one of my favorite shows. So Sex and the City, yeah. I was just like, meh, meh, meh. And then one of my girlfriends yeah. told me after it had been on for a while, she's like, oh my God, you've got to see it. And there was the episode where the politician wants to pee on Carrie's leg. And so she tells
oh
me about
God.
It.
Oh my God, yeah, John Slattery. Yep.
Yes.
Yep.
And so, of course, I got hooked. And not only, I mean, I got so yeah. hooked. It was, I call it my girl Bible. I fucking love that show. Yeah. And then.
Well, you know what's crazy is, I mean, I don't know if you were, I was in New York during the filming of that show, and basically, and I was really good friends with Sarah Jessica at the time. I mean, really weirdly, obviously my life wasn't that. I don't, you know, prance down the street in Manolo Blahnik, but but I also, you know, my favorite part of the show was that it's such a great love letter to New York. Yeah. I mean, I just think it really does capture the magic of New York and why it's my favorite city. So I love that part of it.
Yeah, I'm well.
And obviously, and as I said before, the writing, you know,
the writing was incredible.
Smart.
Oh my God. I mean, it was like when I first started getting into that show, I just couldn't believe how many, in fact, there was, I think it was the first or second season. I don't remember, but they were still talking to the camera. And directly mm-hmm. to the camera. And there was an episode where it was, you know, older women, younger men. And at the time, I was seeing this, I call him Farm Boy. He was, you know, I was what, like 34 or something like that. And he was, or how old was I? No, I was like, I think I was older, 37 or something like that. And he was 23. And he was, mm-hmm. he was from a red state, deep, 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 deep red state. And at the right. time, though, I wasn't hardcore political, but it was just funny because here I was, you know, frolicking with this 23-year-old who might as well have been 18 mentally. And
so you were basically Kim Cattrall.
Yeah, I was. And then like one of the guys in the on the show looked right at the camera and he, you know, it's like, why do I like to have sex with older women? Two words: smart pussy. And I remember I just thought that was so funny. But then you were on the show.
Of course.
You were on the show.
Yes. Yeah. Well, as I said, I was friends with Sarah for a really long time, just from theater, New York. And so they asked me to do the show a bunch. And I couldn't do it because I was doing Third Rock. And then it was the second to last episode ever. And they yes. called and offered the party girl part. And I was like, yes. And I mean, the fact that I even got on the show almost didn't happen.
Wow.
It just sort of never worked out scheduling wise. And it finally worked out. I think it was second to last episode. And it definitely made a big impression. A lot of people in New York would stop me on the street and ask me to, you know, do their outgoing phone message, you know, New York is over, quoting the show. So that was really fun to do.
The episode called Splat.
Yeah.
You know, it's funny. Like yeah. I was saying, Bob and I like to watch it. You know, I mean, I watched it on my own yeah. a million times. And then Bob and I like to go back and revisit it and then, you know, comment on it. And we have so much fun with it. And then so just a few months ago, you know, we were watching the end and we watched the Splat episode. And so like every once in a while, I go over to my mother's house on a Sunday and spend the night with her. And so I was mentioning that episode and how funny it was. So I watched it with her, too. So I've just seen that episode like two or three times. Anyway, so all right, we're going to close. But before we go, I wanted to just ask you. What, you know, when you were growing up, you said you're a feminist, obviously you're very strong and your sarcasm and your humor are terrific. And for me,
thank you, Kimberly.
And I mean that sincerely, you know,
for
me,
I can tell. Yeah. Thank you.
I want to ask you about the women who inspired you. And I mean, I've got a list of women that inspired me when I was growing up, but I want to say that you're mm-hmm. one of them, because I remember watching Third Rock and I remember feeling so close to your type and feeling like, wow, you know, she's doing such an incredible job. She's winning Emmys. She's freaking hilarious. And you inspired me because you made me want to be better at whatever I did, whether it's acting or whatever. It's just because you did such a good job.
What a great thing to say to somebody. Thank you so much.
And you're also inspiring because you've made yourself well. I mean, you took the,
you know. Wait, what did you just say? I didn't hear your last sentence.
I said you're also inspiring because you made yourself well. You know, you.
Oh, yeah.
You made the decision
well,
to live.
For me, you know, if you're going to admire me for anything, and I'm not saying you should, but if you are, it means a lot to me when people, you know, acknowledge my recovery, because really and truly, I have nothing, any kind of funny I have, it's something that God obviously or whoever saw to dole out. For me, the thing I fought hardest for is my sobriety. And so that's the thing I'm proudest of in my life. So,
well, and it's a big effing deal. So, I mean, kudos to you and congratulations. And
thank you.
I mean, everybody's pulling for you, because from what I can see online, I'm not the only one who believes that you're like one of the best parts of that show. I can't say that. I mean,
you.
Allison Janney, she's such a big deal too. Mimi Kennedy, all of them,
yeah.
They're all great. But you certainly brought a breath of freshness to that show that it lacked. And I think it's more complete now. Anyway,
thank
so.
You. Well, I thank you. I don't know how long it'll last. I'd love to be on it for as long as they'll have me. What I said was true. I cannot wait to get to work every day, and I can't wait for people to see the stuff we've already shot. You know, the one coming up this week is Tammy gets a job at a fast food restaurant. It is so funny. You know, just the things they have her doing usually with Allison, you know, it's really funny stuff. So I hope people enjoy it.
Oh, I think they do. Okay, so last questions, just maybe three. Who are like some of the women growing up or even as a woman who have inspired you,
yeah,
and why did they inspire you?
Well, I think for me, there are two actresses as a kid, you know, as a young person. The first is Margaret Hamilton, the Wicked Witch of the West in Wizard of Oz.
Wow.
You know, that performance I saw as a kid, and it was the first time I realized, you know, the power of a performance, and I loved her. I just thought she was a genius. And everyone else watching around me was terrified and crying. And I was like in the corner giggling, you know, I just thought she was awesome. So she's made a huge impact on me. And another actress, Colleen Dewhurst, that I started to get to know a little later, because for me, you know, she epitomized a brilliant actress in New York who lived a great life and did all the kind of acting that I love. You know, she did theater, she did film, she did comedy, she did everything, and she raised a family. She did, you know, she just kicked ass at everything she did. And I just loved, she just inspired me. And then of course there's Meryl Streep, you know,
oh,
I mean,
yeah,
you can't be an actress and not have been inspired by her performances. So
yeah,
those, probably those three as actresses. And in terms of like, you know, humans, probably later in life, you know, sort of reading about her and starting to really understand her life.
Who?
For
Who did
sure,
you say?
Eleanor Roosevelt.
Oh, Eleanor. Okay. Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I'm sure I'll think of 40 others that I can think of later, but those are the first that come to my mind.
Well, I think, you know, you also mentioned in your book that, you know, you loved Judy Blume, and she was somebody,
yes,
that I also, who inspired me. And you know, I didn't even really realize she was inspiring me when I was younger. I just like couldn't
Absolutely.
Read her books fast enough.
Yeah. And then later you kind of realize what a feminist she was and how, you know, sort of she just really forged new roads for women.
Oh, absolutely.
In terms of how women saw them, their sexuality and themselves. And I love, you're absolutely right. I mean, as a young girl reading her, you know, she just helped you understand who you were,
mm-hmm,
and why things happened to you the way they did, and your sexuality. And yeah, she was pretty incredible.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, the first real book I would say I ever read was Forever. And it was because my girlfriend had come to school.
Oh my God, you went straight.
I went straight for it,
stuff.
Man, because my girlfriend, she's like reading the sex parts at lunch, and I couldn't run to the bookstore fast enough after school. And I read it in one day. And then it was like,
start with the, Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret.
Which I thought, what the hell was Margaret's problem? I was such a prude. I did not want my period, and I didn't know what her problems are. Why do you want this?
Yeah, no one really does, do they?
I never understood that. I think it was like kind of like a premonition, because mine turned out to be such a freaking nightmare my whole life. I mean, other people have had it worse, but mine was a nightmare. So.
I know exactly what you mean. That's funny.
All right. Well,
my mind is a nightmare.
Before I let you go,
the fact that we made it this far, Kimberly, it's very impressive. So.
Oh. Well, wait, I want to just say before I let you go, are you doing anything fun for Christmas?
I am. I'm visiting with my family, my mom and my sister. So,
oh, good for you.
I usually keep it pretty low key.
Yeah, that's
good. And definitely I'm going to see some friends Christmas Day. So
that's good. Well, this is the first time I've lived on the East Coast for Christmas since 1977.
Oh, it's so fun. You're going to love it.
Yeah, it's been a long time. So I'm hoping that it snows, although not too hard. But still, I just would like a nice little snow.
Are you in D.C., right? Or are you in New York?
Yeah, I'm in the D.C. area. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't think it's going to snow there, but, I mean, who knows?
Yeah, well, it already snowed. It snowed, I think, in, I don't know, was it November? I don't remember. But
really?
Yeah,
in D.C.?
Yeah, we had one snow, and it was pretty major.
Wow.
It was like 7 inches, so, but it was just one day. Yeah, it was just one day, so. Anyway, well, again, thank you so much for talking to
you. Thank you. I'm so glad we got to meet each other.
I know, me too.
Yeah. Now we've spoken on the phone. It's been great. Really, I love your views. I love, you know, the way you express yourself. I think it's just fantastic. So,
well,
really
ditto. And again, I just want to reiterate, Steph wanted to be here so much. She's also, how do you call it? She's an addict who's recovered.
She's in recovery.
In recovery. And I know you guys would have had a lot to say. It's kind of good, though, because... when we're going to have to figure this out, but I don't know. We're talking to you on the phone, and usually we do like a Skype thing. We haven't figured out how to get three people where one of them is on the phone. So it's kind of worked out this way.
Yeah, well, when you figure that out, I'll come back on.
Yes, we definitely will. You'll have to let me know when you're on hiatus, and we'll work that.
Okay, great.
Well, thank you, Kristen.
Thank you, and tell Bob thank you.
I will. Bob, thank you.
Okay.
Okay. All right.
He's probably asleep. God knows. All right. Bye, you guys.
Bye.
Happy Christmas
Thank
and everything
you.
Else.
You too. Happy New Year. All right. So I just want to say before we get going, that was so awesome because she's always been somebody who I've, like I said, admired and was inspired by. And so I'm just so thrilled to have an opportunity to talk to her. I just can't even believe that Kristen Johnston was on my show. So thank you for listening, and see you next time.